35. Squatting with his palms on a thin mat in the center of his Spartan living room, Braxton Price pressed his knees into his arms and slipped into a crow pose, getting both feet off the ground. He was nearing the end of what had been an invigorating 90-minute yoga workout. Braxton had the build of an elite athlete, though it was difficult to see under his nurse's uniform. Before he became a nurse, Braxton had worn a different uniform, that of a Green Beret in the United States Army. After 21 continuous months of combat in Afghanistan, Braxton joined a small combat team tasked with training and arming Afghan fighters who wished to rebel against the Taliban. It was good work, honest work, bloody work. He was part of a somewhat loosely organized counterinsurgency effort promoted by General David Petraeus to win the locals' hearts and minds. As a weapons sergeant, Braxton served a key role in the Green Beret's 12-member Alpha Team, the A-Team. Before his deployment to the Middle East, Braxton had attended 43 weeks of weapons sergeant school, where he learned how to adapt to any situation and improvise on the field. He could speak Pashto better than Dari, but was conversant in both. Braxton came to appreciate his interaction with the locals, but it was nothing compared to the high he got as part of a hunter-killer team, smashing down doors and putting bullets into targets. Killing was just a part of the job, and he did it without remorse. Braxton's time in Afghanistan might have come to an end, but he was not lacking for work. His new role required a dozen weeks of training, during which he learned all about charting, taking vitals, administering drugs intravenously, rudimentary knowledge at best. He could hardly be considered a registered nurse, but one day, just like that, he had a badge with the name Lee Taggart and was on staff at the VA. No questions asked. Even though he did no real nursing, he knew it was good work, honest work, bloody work. Braxton got into a plank position on his mat. 30 seconds into the hold, he could feel every muscle fiber start to twitch. Closing his eyes, Braxton let his mind replay Steve Evington's final screams. Fucking Gantry, he thought. Curtis Gantry was a thug, prone to violence and lacking professionalism. But he was also Braxton's best friend, former A-team member, and the guy who had saved his life more times than he had fingers. But this part of the operation was Braxton's to run as he saw fit, and not Gantry's. In hindsight, he should have made Gantry put a bullet in Abington's head. The screams did not bother Braxton in the least, but Abington was a brother in arms, and he deserved to go quick. Braxton knew all about the long suffer. Some of his interrogations in Afghanistan had lasted for weeks. The job description was information extraction, not torture, but the line was a blurry one at best. Braxton kept his enjoyment of the work a secret, thinking he otherwise might not get it. 1.5 minutes holding the plank, and Braxton looked like a bronze statue. His core was on fire, but there was no noticeable shake in his arms or legs. Fitness was always a passion. He could be sent back to war tomorrow and do just fine over there. In a way, he was still at war, doing battle of a different sort. At the 2-minute mark, one of Braxton's cell phones rang, the important one. Braxton cursed. He had 2 more minutes to go in his hold. But only one person had that phone number, and the call needed to be answered. Braxton sprang to his feet and padded across the 2-bedroom condo's gleaming hardwood floor. Light spilled in through a bank of bay windows that framed a glorious view of the Charles River. It would be impossible to afford this place on a soldier's salary, but his current employers were more than happy to pay the bill. In return, he was more than happy to answer their phone call.
"Speak," Braxton said. "The girl. I figured."
Braxton recognized the baritone voice with a distinctive rasp. He saw no reason not to speak freely. Besides, these were stealth phones that used a machine-generated international mobile equipment identifier to make calls more secure and virtually untraceable. A warning system would alert Braxton if somebody were trying to intercept the call. In that case, he would turn his phone off and on to reset the IMEI number, dive back into the shadows.
"She's proving to be a problem."
"I'm not surprised," Braxton said.
"She's tenacious. Is there an order, sir?"
A pause. Braxton made no inference. He waited for his next instruction as he had been trained.
"Can Gantry be trusted? To not hurt her?" "We're not there just yet." Yeah, I think Gantry can be trusted.
Braxton's mind flashed on Gantry's twisted grin as he stood at the lip of the pit, lighter in hand, Abington moments from immolation.
He can be trusted, for sure. I'll call back when we know what we want him to do.
Very good, Braxton said.
What about the next one?
We still need him. Fine with Braxton as well. He got paid regardless.
You know, I'm scheduled for a shift, but there's no removals pending. We can take care of that. You're sick until further notice.
I'm sick, all right, Braxton said with a laugh.
Just make sure Gantry does what we want. You know you can count on me, sir, Braxton said.
Braxton called him sir because anybody over him in the food chain was a sir. It was not meant as a show of respect.
Very well. I'll be in touch.
Braxton ended the call and returned to his mat. He got back into the plank position and began his hold once more. 30 seconds into it, and Braxton was questioning his endorsement of Gantry. While he considered Gantry a friend, Braxton knew he would do something to Carrie Bryant before he killed her, and he doubted it would have anything to do with fire. Chapter 36. Rita Abington lived on a busy street in a ramshackle ranch home with a sagging roof and paint-chipped front stairs. The yard was just a small square, a bit more brown than green, with nothing to spruce it up, no landscaping of any kind. Shrubs grew as they wished, and a few of the taller trees might have been bent by ice storms, never straightening. Carrie followed David up the narrow front walk. She noticed that all of the curtains were drawn. The only indication someone might be home was the Chevy Cobalt parked in the narrow driveway, battered looking as the house. David pushed the doorbell, but nothing happened. No rings, no chimes. He knocked. Carrie heard footsteps from within, and a moment later the door came open just a crack to reveal part of a woman's hard-bitten face. The woman said,
"I don't want to buy nothing, save a whale, or go to heaven. So I figure you've got no business being here."
David laughed. The woman spoke with a notable Down East accent. She also had a throaty voice, and Carrie suspected an x-ray of her lungs would reveal at least a pack-a-day habit.
"Are you Rita Abington?" David asked.
"Depends if you're looking for money."
"I'm looking for your son, Steve."
With that, the door came fully open to reveal a tiny woman, thin up top and below, wearing a sleeveless white blouse that showed off moles like archipelagos dotting her arms. Her skin was brown and wrinkled, but it appeared to be from hard living rather than too much sun. She had sunken cheeks and a neck thin enough to give Carrie a good look at the tendons. Rita's hair came down to her shoulders and was thin, like the rest of her, with all the color and luster of what might be found in one of her ashtrays. Rita said,
"You seen Stevie?"
"We were hoping you had," Carrie said. Rita stepped aside. Carrie figured this was her way of inviting them in, and she went, with David following. The living room was not much more than a few pieces of Goodwill furniture spread out over a well-worn rug. The stale smell of smoke hovered in the air and taxed Carrie's breathing some, but she managed to ignore it after a few minutes. Plenty of pictures hung on the walls and stood on tables. Apparently, Steve was not Rita Abington's only child. Carrie and David waited on the plaid sofa while Rita got a pitcher of iced tea from the kitchen. She poured 3 glasses and took a seat on an armchair covered by a patchwork quilt. She lit up, Benson and Hedges, and took a puff. This was her home, and she saw no reason to ask anybody's permission.
"Forgive me," Rita said. "I haven't had a lot of visitors come around. It's been quiet here since Winston died."
"Was Winston your husband?"
David asked.
"My dog," Rita said. "I got more love from that little dog than I ever did my ex, rest his soul."
With that, Rita rose from her chair, the cigarette dangling in a practiced way between 2 long fingers, went to the hallway and removed a picture from the wall. She handed the framed photograph to Carrie and used her hand to fan away the smoke. "He's so cute," Carrie said of the tiny, silky-haired dog with ears reminiscent of furry satellite dishes. "What kind of dog was Winston?"
"I don't know," Rita said as she took a puff. "A good one. That's enough."
Carrie showed the picture to David, who acknowledged Winston's cuteness with a smile. Carrie hung the picture back on the wall and noticed another framed photograph, long and rectangular, this one of a group of soldiers, some wearing shirts and others without. Not all of the guys had beards, but everyone had guns. Carrie pointed at this photo. "Is this Steve?" she asked. Rita came over, squinting, to take a look. She took the rectangular photo off the wall. "Eyes aren't so good these days," she said, almost apologizing. Her expression brightened. "That's Stevie right there," she pointed. "How do you know my Stevie, anyway?"
"I'm his doctor," Carrie said. "I was treating him, and, well, he sort of took off."
Rita carried the photograph back to her seat.
"He's always taken off," she said.
"Have you heard from him?" Carrie asked.
Rita spit out a laugh. "That's a good one. No, no, I haven't," she said.
"My two other boys haven't either. Ben lives over to Orono, who comes to visit from time to time with the grandkids. Ian, well, let's just say he likes fishing more than he likes people."
Tough life, hard living, Carrie thought of the Abington clan. Rita would have no idea about Steve's DBS operation or his involvement with the DARPA program, and Carrie was not about to violate his privacy by sharing those details. Her vague answer about being Abington's doctor had seemed to satisfy Rita's equally vague curiosity. Carrie got the sense all Rita really cared about was hearing Steve's voice one more time. "Would you have any idea where he might have gone?" Carrie asked. Rita let her gaze travel to the floor.
"I haven't seen him in years. I couldn't tell you."
"So he had no contact with his family?"
"None," Rita said. "He came back from that war, broken. No other way to put it. Stevie used to be my sweetie pie. Light of my life. He was the example for his brothers. But when he came back, it was just a ghost to that boy. Not the kid I raised. He took to the drink and the drugs, for sure, but there was more. He left something back in that desert."
"What's that?" Carrie asked. A shadow crossed Rita's face.
"His soul," she said.
Carrie stood, crossed the room, and put her hand on Rita's shoulder. The woman gazed up, clutched Carrie's hand, and batted back some tears.
"He was a good boy," Rita said, looking at the framed picture in her lap. "The sweetest."
Carrie stooped and pointed to the thin, muscular man in the photograph who had his arm around Steve.
"Who is that?" she asked.
A sad smile of some memory deepened the wrinkles on Rita's face.
"Why, that's Roach," Rita said. "Stevie's best buddy. They called him Roach on account of nothing could ever kill him. Nothing. Then he died in Stevie's arms. Honestly, I think that's when it all began to go bad for him."
Roach. The name meant a lot to Carrie, but she kept quiet about the terrifying ordeal during which Steve had asked for his departed friend. Carrie's eyes fell on another man in the photograph, this one taller than most, with broad shoulders and a handsome face. He had the neck of a football player, but without the asymmetry of the stimulating wires she had observed during her examination. Ramon Hernandez's dazzling smile contradicted the photograph's harsh setting. Carrie's thoughts reeled. How was it two people who'd had contact with each other over in Afghanistan ended up in the same DARPA DBS program? Did Hernandez refer Abington? Or was their involvement coincidental?
"Did Steve know this man?" Carrie said, pointing to Hernandez.
Rita shook her head.
"If he did, he didn't mention it to me."
As Carrie studied the photograph one more time, she noticed a figure in the background, tall and lean, shirtless and rippling with muscles, his face partly obscured by shadows. She could not make out the visage, but the man called to mind Lee Taggart, the nurse working the neuro recovery floor the night Eric Fasciani disappeared. The Green Garden Inn was just off the highway and was the kind of roadside motel Carrie's father seemed always drawn to on long family drives. It was nothing special, green vinyl siding, black shutters, and landscaping that looked like a PGA golf course compared to Rita's place. Night had fallen and Carrie was ready to let go of the day, the endless, fruitless search. Put on some bad television and drift off into oblivion. David brought in the plastic bag with two toothbrushes, some sweatpants and t-shirts they had bought at Walmart, and the paper bag with takeout Chinese food. Though she was ravenous, Carrie took a 15-minute shower. She thought about Ramon Hernandez. She'd told David about seeing him in the photo, and he thought it could be a coincidence. If she'd been sure the other man was Lee Taggart, she wouldn't have let David convince her. Out of the shower, Carrie put on her new sweats. Her hair was tangled and stringy, and a quick check in the bathroom mirror confirmed she looked as exhausted as she felt. Not the impression she had wanted to make, not even close. When she emerged from the bathroom, David was slurping noodles from a paper carton and drinking Heineken from a glass bottle, lying on one of the two twin beds and watching ESPN.
"Your dinner is on the table," he said. "Happy to change the channel if you want."
Carrie scooped up a bowl of chicken and broccoli, grabbed a Heineken David had opened and set on ice, and climbed onto the empty bed, feeling better than she had all day.
"Do you want me to change it?"
David asked. Carrie looked up at the television and shrugged. "It's fine," she said. "I've been watching a lot of ESPN with Adam since I moved back home."
"You know, I was going to ask you about that."
"About why I'm 29 and living with my parents?"
"You forgot brain surgeon."
"You really want the whole story?" David gave Carrie a sidelong glance.
"I'm a reporter. I may write the Cliff Notes version, but I don't ever ask for it."
He shut off the TV. For the next 20 minutes, Carrie provided a detailed accounting of everything that had happened at BCH, starting with Beth Stilwell and ending with her resignation. She could not fathom why it felt so comfortable, so natural to share with him, but it did. Once she started to open up, she could not stop. David sat on the bed facing Carrie, with his feet on the floor and his food going cold. On occasion, he'd sip from his beer, but mostly his eyes were on her the entire time. And Carrie thought that was just fine. When she finished, Carrie gave a little shrug because she had nothing more to say. David took a final swig of his beer.
"You didn't have to quit," he said. "Dr. Metcalf was in charge. You were just a resident."
"It was my fault," Carrie said.
"But you're a damn good doc."
"You can't say that for sure. I've never operated on your brain."
"But if I needed brain surgery, I would totally want you to do it. I have a really good gut instinct for this sort of thing."
Carrie chuckled. "Yeah, well, talent isn't everything. You were good at your job, and look where they got you."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"It means you were a great stringer, if that's the right term. Putting yourself at risk, doing more than the others, always pushing the boundaries. And because of that, you were taken captive, held hostage, and suddenly your maverick ways turned you from an asset to a liability. Our stories aren't so dissimilar, if you think about it." David gave this some serious thought.
"We both pushed ourselves out of the jobs we loved.
And now, here we are in a motel room in the middle of Maine."
"Yeah, here we are," David said.
A lengthy silence followed. David swung his feet back on the bed and turned up the volume on the TV, a couple clicks, to hear a report on how the Pacers had outlasted the Celtics in a grueling overtime match. The scroll bar along the bottom of the screen was nothing but a string of abstract letters and numbers. Carrie had no focus, and her thoughts became fuzzy as her arms and legs seemed to melt into the bed. Her eyelids were shutting, voluntarily or not. They snapped back open when David spoke up.
"Goodwin," he said.
"What?
Why doesn't she want you to see the patients post-op?"
Carrie shook her head and dislodged a few of the cobwebs. "I don't know," she said. "It's her policy. She's a control freak, I guess."
"What if she's not?"
David suggested.
"What do you mean?"
David returned to his earlier position, feet on the floor, eyes on Carrie.
"I guess what I'm getting at is, what if the
Palynacusis, Carrie said.
"Yeah, that. What if it only happens in a few patients, not all of them? And that's why Goodwin doesn't want you or Dr. Finley to look after her charges. She doesn't want you to know."
Carrie mulled this over. "But there's been a lot of patients, David. Somebody would have found out by now."
"Not if it's temporary," he said. "She makes sure nobody knows about it, or if they do, it gets reported to her or Navarro, and that information doesn't get back to you."
"But why?" Carrie asked. Here, David shrugged.
"That's the big question, isn't it?"
"So why did Abington and Fasciani check out AMA?"
"Maybe something was different with those two, and Abington and Fasciani had to disappear. Something about their symptoms wasn't going to be temporary."
"Then explain to me how she got them to leave," Carrie asked.
"She could have paid them off, or Maybe she took them.
Kidnapping?
It's a possibility.
Goodness, you're a conspiracy theorist, David. Who knew?
David held up his hands, evidently pleased to embrace the label.
I think there's a reason Goodwin wants to keep you from looking at those patients, and that it goes beyond protocol. That's all I'm saying.
We would need a motive. Why would Goodwin want to hide a potential side effect and then purposefully work to remove patients not only from the program but the hospital?
I know a way we could find out, David said.
How, by asking her?
As a reporter, I've had to learn things about people they wouldn't say directly to my face, David said almost apologetically. So let's just say I have access to some devices that could aid our effort.
Elaborate, please.
If you want to know Goodwin's private conversations, you've got to listen to them.
You want to bug Goodwin's office?
Think about everything you've experienced so far. It all points back to Goodwin. She's up to something, Carrie. The question is, what?
I'll think about it, Carrie said.
You can help me get inside, and I can set it up. The offer is on the table.
I appreciate it, Carrie said, and she meant it. David went back to watching television. Carrie turned her gaze to the ceiling. She was not thinking about bugging Goodwin or any possible motive for hiding the patients. She was thinking about David. Part of it, she knew, was driven by loneliness. While Carrie did not regret putting her career first and foremost in her life priorities, she was also a woman with needs. But she was not ready to act on the impulse. Not yet, anyway. The focus had to be on Abington and Fasciani. It had to be on saving her career. Mind reading, Carrie knew, was nothing but a parlor trick. Even so, she caught David looking at her and sensed he was having similar thoughts. Carrie held his gaze a moment, then said, "Well, it's late and I'm pretty tired. I'll see you in the morning. Thanks for being there for me, David. It means a lot." Carrie shut off her bedside lamp and turned her back to David. David said,
"You know, I would have helped you even without getting the story."
In the darkness, Carrie smiled. Chapter 37. Carrie used the VA locker room to change into her running clothes. Her sneakers, size 9 Newtons, the color of watermelon, with electric blue piping, felt stiff from non-use. Soon enough, she imagined, her legs would be aching from non-use as well. She had no particular destination in mind, just a desire to get out there and slap some pavement. Her body ached from a bad night's sleep on a crummy mattress, plus all those hours of driving, and a good run would hopefully loosen her up. She and David had returned from Maine late morning, and Carrie had gone straight to the VA to visit with Gerald Wright for his pre-op consultation. Wright, a 65-year-old grandfather of 11 and a fighter pilot during the Vietnam War, had been on the surgical schedule for months. His advanced stage Parkinson's disease couldn't have cared less about 2 missing vets and Carrie's growing concern about DBS therapy. She had contemplated backing out of the surgery altogether, but worried that might make Goodwin overly suspicious, more careful of what she was willing to say behind closed doors. On the drive south, Carrie had given David the green light to get whatever equipment was necessary to conduct the surveillance. She trusted his instincts about Goodwin, among other things, including his belief that the right operation would go without a hitch.
"It's not Parkinson's, that's the problem," David had said. "There are too many DBS procedures involving patients with that condition. Something would have surfaced by now. It's got to be related to PTSD.
It was strange to be back at the VA. Everything felt so normal.
Dr. Finley had joined Carrie for the pre-op consultation, and he seemed to be in a jovial mood. Immediately following her meeting with Wright, Carrie gave Dr. Finley a briefing on her search and expressed regret at not having made more progress.
"I appreciate your efforts," Dr. Finley said. "But as I told you back in my office, not everybody who has had the procedure returns for follow-up appointments. We are dealing with very fragmented individuals here."
When Carrie mentioned seeing Ramon Hernandez in a photograph with Abington, he did not seem at all fazed by the discovery.
"It could be that's how Steve got involved. I can check with Ramon or Cal Trent, but there is a referral component to the DARPA program, so it's not entirely surprising to find a connection between them."
Something that was probably nothing.
All this did was get Carrie's thoughts churning even faster. Maybe what she had observed in Abington and Fasciani was an aberration, and her theory about palinacusis was entirely groundless. After all, Fasciani never actually articulated what she assumed was the condition. It was his behavior that had made her suspect it. Perhaps she was projecting symptoms on these two men to fit a puzzle she'd created. Her doubts were not enough to call off David's plan to bug Goodwin's office. She was willing to accept Ramon's connection to Abington as potentially coincidental, but there were too many other unusual happenings for Carrie to discount. In any event, a good run might pound some clarity into an increasingly murky situation. After some light stretching in the parking lot, Carrie tightened the laces of her shoes and set off at what she thought was a 10-minute mile pace. The cityscape provided the perfect backdrop. She had enough to look at to keep her interested, but not so many cars and pedestrians to make it dangerous or distracting. She turned right on Bryn Mawr Street, thinking it might be nice to run through Healy Park. Evidently, she was not the only one with this idea. It was not the starting line in Hopkinton on Marathon Monday by any stretch, but plenty of joggers, bikers, and walkers were catching the final rays of sunshine on what had turned into a pleasantly cool afternoon. Carrie's mind was beginning to let go, and she remembered why she had fallen in love with running. 20 minutes into her jog, her lungs felt great. Concern about her out-of-shape legs became an unfounded worry. The pitch was mostly level, but a few hills challenged her breathing and form. Out of the corner of her eye, Carrie caught a flash of movement. In the next few seconds, a couple, fit and trim and dressed in fancy athletic gear, zipped past her on the right. Carrie quickened her pace to keep up until her lungs begged her to retreat. She slipped back to her natural gait, slowed her speed considerably, and laughed at her competitiveness. Always trying to be the best, always pushing the limits. It reminded Carrie of her conversation with David in the motel room, about the symmetry of their circumstances. She had almost succumbed to impulse and climbed into bed with him. It probably would not have been something she'd have regretted. Part of her wondered if that had been on David's mind as well. Carrie was not sure what drew her attention to the jogger behind her. She glanced over her shoulder at the muscular man who wore blue Nike training pants and a dark running jacket. A Red Sox baseball hat and sunglasses concealed most of his head and face. Carrie ran on, but she could hear the man behind her, his footfalls landing like soft taps against the pavement. Curious if he was going to pass her, Carrie looked again. He had not gained a step. He also did not appear to be breathing very hard. This guy with tree trunks for legs must have another gear, but for whatever reason he'd opted not to use it. He evidently preferred to run behind Carrie, in that dead space where he was not a stalker but not invisible either. There was plenty of room for all runners, and after 100 yards with him on her tail it got irritating. She decided to put some pep in her step and lose the guy. Her muscles responded, and soon she was running at what felt like a 9-minute mile pace. Carrie's heart rate jacked and her lungs felt squeezed, but it was a manageable pace, at least for a while. After about a minute, Carrie took a peek behind and saw the same man running the exact same distance away from her. He had not fallen back, not even a few feet, which meant he had increased his speed to match Carrie's. It did not look like he was breathing any harder either. Once again, he maintained the exact distance that allowed him to be a presence, but not a threat. Carrie switched sides of the road and picked up her pace a little bit more. She was probably running a sub-9-minute mile now, well outside her comfort zone. Whatever her exact speed, Carrie's form suffered as a result, and she no longer landed with the midfoot strike that helped prevent injury. The bad form caused joint strain and made her breathing even more labored. But she pushed on, refusing to look behind her, not wanting to give in to curiosity or fuel her growing unease. Her resolve lasted all of 10 strides. As she passed a tall oak tree, Carrie craned her neck to look over her left shoulder and immediately spotted the same man running behind her. He had crossed the road with her and picked up speed to keep pace. His arms pumped effortlessly, and his legs looked as if they could go on moving that way forever. This run was nothing to him. She could tell. He acted completely nonchalant. To anybody else, it would look like two runners working out. Maybe he was using her as a pace car or for motivation. Since other joggers were around, Carrie was not too panicked, but she had moved beyond just being annoyed. "It's your mind playing tricks," Carrie assured herself. "Nothing more." She ran another 50 yards with the man in the dark hat and sunglasses behind her before she decided to turn around. She slowed and made a wide, arching turn, and a few moments later she passed Hatman on her left. He kept his head forward and his running rhythm steady with no change in direction. She took one glance behind her and saw Hatman was still running away from her, just a guy out doing his own thing. Carrie laughed at her paranoia and kept her gaze forward as she ran. The urge to look back once more felt almost oppressive, but she refused to cave into her paranoia again. The incident was innocuous, she decided. She continued at a pace still above her norm, but the urge to look back would not let go. Just take one look, one quick check, one little glance. Carrie turned her head, and her body followed. As her gaze traveled back, a feeling of relief came over her. Nobody was there. Once again, Carrie laughed at her perceived ridiculousness. Fear was easy to catch. This made her think of Adam and how he lived with that sinking feeling almost every second of the day. Like Abington and Fasciani, Adam was caught in terror's unrelenting grasp. Ahead, she spied a turnoff to a cut-through that bisected the park. The path was narrow and paved with dirt, less demanding on the joints, and Carrie went that way. The sides of the path were lined with tall grasses and trees with budding leaves. Carrie absorbed the scenic beauty, appreciating every bush, cloud, and birdsong. Behind her, a new sound entered her ears. The soft crunching of dirt. Somebody running. The tall grasses became a long green blur in Carrie's peripheral vision. It's nothing, Carrie told herself. 5 yards became 10, but Carrie still did not look back. 15? Then 20. The impulse to check was irresistible. She turned her body and gave a look. A sinking feeling swallowed her gut and Carrie's pulse took off. He was there, running behind her, hat on his head, sunglasses in place, keeping the same distance as before. Carrie had no idea how he'd snuck up on her, but she believed he wanted her to notice him. Fear uncoiled as a surge of adrenaline hastened her strides. Carrie's heart hammered in her throat. She looked ahead, but the dirt path was vacant. No other joggers or bikers in sight. She broke into a sprint, panting. Her eyes started to tear, and her thoughts turned black with terror. Her burning lungs needed more air. She opened her mouth wider, but that did little to help. Straining her ears, Carrie heard the persistent patter of footsteps. Panic set in. She looked left, then right. Would the tall grasses give her an escape route, or would they just slow her down? She decided to keep to the path, run as hard as she possibly could. Her only chance was to get to the main road and find someone to help. Carrie staggered sideways, unable to keep a straight line. Her eyes stayed fixed to the ground as she navigated around roots and rocks. Despite the intense exertion on her legs and lungs, Carrie managed to find still another gear. Her arms were pumping wildly to keep up the pace. Ahead, she saw an opening where the cut-through path intersected the main road. People would be there, and safety. Carrie risked another check behind her. He was still there, running at a brisk pace, but as before, he did not appear to be gaining. Why? Was he toying with her? Did he get off on her fear? She saw a smile on his face and a flash of something in his hand, a knife or perhaps even a gun. The tall grasses that she'd thought might aid her escape would be the perfect place to hide her rape or murder. A fresh blast of terror filled her. She wanted to scream, but her battered lungs needed every bit of air and left nothing for her voice. The path ended, maybe 100 yards ahead. He could still catch her. She sprinted in a blind panic. How could she have been so stupid to take this cut through? The road was about 75 yards away. Her focus wavered. In the next instant, Carrie's ankle twisted, sending her sprawling. She landed on the hard, packed ground and skidded several feet on her knees. Momentum carried her forward, and she got back to her feet almost without breaking stride. Her only recourse was to keep running, and she refused to waste a second to see if he was gaining. Of course he was. He had to be. The ankle burned, as did her knees where she skidded, and every other stride hurt like running barefoot across shards of glass. Don't look, don't look. Just run. But Carrie could not resist. Her back and head turned, and the man was there, 5 feet away, sporting a broad grin on his face. A scream of sorts escaped from her lips, more like a low moan that grew increasingly louder. Sweat glossed her skin, and her thoughts became gummed with terror. Her legs kicked furiously, arms swinging in wild arcs. The numbness in the legs turned intense, beyond unpleasant. Her lungs screamed for her to stop, but Carrie blocked out the pain and she urged herself on. Faster! Faster! She wondered if it was the man's breath that made her neck so hot. She could almost feel his fingers gripping at her clothes. 5 more steps. 5 more! As Carrie stumbled from the path, she collided with a female jogger who had no time to react. The impact was not too much, but Carrie's weakened ankle sent her tumbling to the ground. The other jogger let out a gasp, and once she figured out what had just happened, turned back to Carrie. "Are you all right?" she asked, without offering to help her to her feet. Carrie was down on her stomach, unable to see the path, but she still managed to get out a warning. "Behind you! Behind you!" she yelled. "He's behind you!" The woman turned to look as Carrie scrambled to her feet. A moment later, the man in the baseball cap emerged from the cut-through with a worried look on his face. He came over to Carrie, and she saw now a scar like a jagged lightning bolt on his cheek, and a shamrock tattoo that decorated the side of his neck.
"Nasty tumble you took there," he said.
Carrie skirted back several feet. "Get away from me," she snapped. The man looked only slightly aggrieved.
"Hey, I was just trying to help," he said with a shrug and a what-can-I-do kind of smile.
He turned on his heels and started back down the same dirt path.
"Do you need me to call the cops?" the woman jogger asked.
"No," Carrie said. "I'm fine. Thanks for asking. Sorry to run into you." The jogger waved and went on her way. Favoring her good ankle, Carrie watched Hat Man run away from her. Soon enough, he was a pinprick on the horizon, and then he was gone. All she saw were the tall grasses swaying in concert with the gentle breeze. Chapter 38 Adam was shooting hoops when Carrie got home. She parked her car in the pullout and ambled over to him, trying to not favor her swelling left ankle. Worried about alarming everyone, especially Adam, Carrie had decided to keep the incident at the park a secret. Adam took a shot, swished it from 15 feet out, got his rebound, and bounced the ball with a display of his substantial dribbling skills. He appraised Carrie warily.
"What happened to you?" he asked.
Carrie was taken aback. She thought she'd done a good job of concealing the minor sprain and glanced down to make sure her pants hid the scrapes from her fall.
"I'm fine. Why do you ask?"
"You're limping," Adam said. Irene had passed her keen observation genes to her son as well as to her daughter.
"It's nothing," Carrie said.
Adam tossed Carrie the basketball with a little heat on the pass. He never held back when it came to playing sports. He loved competition, as did Carrie, but he took it to a whole different level. It was one aspect of his personality that had driven him into the military. Carrie took a shot, but her balance was off on account of her ankle, and the ball clanged off the rim. Adam snagged the rebound, and in a fluid, dancer-like motion, turned and fired a jump shot that sent the ball in a high arc before it eventually found the center of the hoop. Everything about Adam's body was in perfect working order, Carrie observed. He was lithe, agile, and quick on his feet. It was a bit surreal to see how able he appeared when Carrie knew he was anything but.
"You seem a little shaken," Adam said, dribbling once more. "Everything all right?"
On a whim, she decided to tell the truth. The experience had been truly frightening. Who better to share it with than someone who understood fear so well?
"Oh, I just had a really creepy, scary incident at the park while I was running. It's nothing."
Adam's stern expression indicated otherwise.
"What happened?"
Carrie had not spaced on Adam's overly protective tendencies. The dark expression that overtook Adam's face after she had finished was more than a little unsettling.
"You sure he was just using you to set the pace?" Adam said.
"I don't know. I think so," Carrie said, not sounding at all convinced.
"He came up to me after and seemed to feel badly about it."
Adam said, "Yeah, well, don't trust anybody. And run with somebody else, will you please? I told you that like 1,000 times. People do terrible things to each other, Carrie. Really terrible things."
Carrie was not sure whether Adam was talking about the jogger in the park or himself. She set her hands on Adam's shoulders.
"Look, it's nothing," she said. "I'm fine, and I'll be more careful next time."
Adam took a couple dribbles to get centered and looked at Carrie the way she might examine a patient during a pre-op exam.
She could tell he was looking for any hint of deceit. Adam said nothing, but it seemed he had picked up on Carrie's lingering apprehension.
It really was harmless, Carrie said.
In the back of her mind, though, she wondered about the timing. The incident with the jogger came on the heels of her plot to bug Goodwin, and in the middle of her search for two missing bets. Still unconvinced, Adam said,
Just remember, I'm your brother. I'm always going to look out for you, always.
Adam slugged Carrie playfully in the arm, and she slugged him back with an even lighter tap. During this exchange, the garage door came open, and Carrie snatched the ball from Adam's grasp while he was distracted. She launched a solid 10-footer that found the net, no problem. Howard Bryant emerged from the garage carrying a tray of gardening tools, dressed for that sort of work. He set down the tools and sauntered over to his kids.
Who's up for a game of horse?
Howard asked with a star-bright smile on his face. Like their mother, Howard wanted his two children living on their own, but the sparkle in his eyes said he would cherish every moment spent together as a family, under any circumstance. Adam passed the ball to his father with maybe a little less zip than his delivery to Carrie. Not missing a beat, Howard caught the ball with two hands, took a couple of dribbles, and fired off a shot that could have been a mirror of Adam's earlier jumper. It hit nothing but net. The game commenced as the sun beat a final retreat, and birdsong filled the sweet-smelling air with joyful chatter. Howard started off the game with a layup, made it, and passed the ball to Adam, who also made the shot. Carrie, still favoring her left ankle, dribbled awkwardly to the hoop and clanged the ball off the rim.
Carrie's a bit lame, Adam said.
Carrie acted indignant.
We're playing horse, she said. I'm not one.
Just keep the move and shoot to a minimum, Dad. I'd hate for us to have to put her down.
Howard made a face, but the truth was that he'd been encouraging Adam to lighten up, to relax. Any show of levity was a minor victory in an otherwise endless war. Howard saved his expression of concern for Carrie.
Did you hurt yourself, sweetheart?
He asked. Carrie shot Adam a nervous glance, fearing he might say something about the incident in the park. Her dad might not think it was so innocuous either. The world was full of predators, and Carrie was not interested in a lecture on safety. Adam gave Carrie a look that said she could trust him.
I'm fine, Carrie said. It's just a slight sprain, that's all. I fell while jogging. I can still take you boys on.
The winner of the game was basically predetermined. The real contest was between Howard and Carrie for second place. Adam seemed to relish his expected victory, and a fraction of a grin overtook his face, until his gaze settled on the dysfunctional Camaro visible in the garage. Adam stomped over to the garage, pushed the button to shut the door, and returned to the basketball game with a look of disgust.
Come morning, I'm turning that pile of metal into scrap, he said.
The glower on Adam's face remained until he buried three free throws in a row. Neither Carrie nor Howard reacted. They had heard the same threat many times before. Carrie tried another shot and missed. H-O. Not wanting to earn the final three letters, Carrie decided her ankle needed a more supportive sneaker. She excused herself to go inside and change footwear. Carrie could not locate the sneakers she wanted in her closet at first, but eventually saw them to the left of her black riding boots. It was a bit odd. Carrie was normally fastidious about her closet, and those sneakers were always to the right of her boots, kept in order of size. She sat on the bed and put on her sneakers, then got up to feed Limbic. While Limbic gobbled every flake of food offered, Carrie opened her dresser to change into a different t-shirt. Right away, she could tell someone had rifled through her clothing. Her shirts were folded, but not exactly as she would have done it. Close, but not perfect. Not her stamp. Carrie was on high alert, every muscle tense. She scanned her bedroom for other anomalies. They were not especially difficult to spot. The sheet on her bed had not been pulled as tight as she would have done, and a stack of papers on her desk seemed closer to the window by about 6 inches. All these details were minor, but Carrie cut her teeth obsessing over the minor details. She noticed everything. Somebody had been in her room. Not just in her room, but looking through her things. Carrie tried to make sense of it and arrived at one disturbing conclusion. Adam had spied on her. Who else could have done it? As much as she tried, Carrie could not come up with another logical explanation. His mental state was obviously fragile, but he had never done anything this strange, this out of character. Carrie's pulse accelerated as she descended the stairs, but at the bottom step, she paused. Deep breaths. Deep breaths. The surge of anger subsided like the tide rolling out to sea. There was an answer, Carrie assured herself. It would just take a conversation with Adam to clear things up. Outside, Carrie found her father and brother shooting around. She approached tentatively, hands on her hips. Howard stopped dribbling and said, "What happened to you? You look pale." Carrie's heart fluttered as the anger returned. "Was somebody in my room?" She looked right at Adam, and her composure vanished.
"What are you talking about?"
Howard asked. "Somebody went through all my things, my clothes, under the bed. Somebody was in my room." Adam's eyes narrowed and his face reddened like a boiled lobster.
"Why are you looking at me?" he asked.
"I'm just asking," Carrie snapped. "I'm trying to figure it out." Howard said,
"No, no, of course not. Nobody went into your room."
Adam took a step forward.
"Are you accusing me of something?"
His voice held violence. His eyes were like pools of lava bubbling just below the surface and about to go volcanic. Carrie changed her approach. One slight push might be enough to send Adam over the edge. "I'm trying to figure out if somebody went into my room or not, that's all." The answer, of course, was that somebody had been in there. The question was who. Adam was not about to retreat. He had been accused of wrongdoing and felt victimized.
"Maybe you're getting paranoid," he said. "First you think a guy is chasing you in the park, and now they're rummaging through your stuff."
"What guy?" Howard asked, turning to Carrie.
"It's nothing, Dad."
Adam let the basketball roll into the woods and approached Carrie in a menacing, threatening manner. His shoulders were forward, his arms out in front of his body, palms facing up.
"Maybe the jogger is the guy who went into your room," he said.
Maybe, Carrie thought, but that seemed incredible. It was too bizarre to reconcile. Why would somebody go into her room? What could they be looking for?
"Were you here all day?" Carrie asked, not yet ready to back down.
"Easy, Carrie, easy."
"Yeah, I've been here all day, going through your crap."
"Adam, that's not necessary," Carrie said in a softer tone. "I'm just trying to understand what happened."
"Understand this," Adam said.
He held up two hands with his two middle fingers fully extended, then turned and marched his indignation all the way down the driveway.
Carrie felt sick to her stomach, but it had been the most logical conclusion. While her mother and father were out and about, Adam had free rein around the house.
Howard appeared crestfallen.
"You have to be careful with him, Carrie," he admonished.
Now she felt even worse. Disappointing her father, her hero, even a smidge, put a crimp on her heart.
"I'm sorry, Dad, but somebody was in my room."
"Well, obviously it wasn't your mother or me, and I'm willing to believe Adam. You're under a lot of strain, Carrie."
Carrie took a sharper tone.
"Are you suggesting I'm making it up? I know what I saw, Dad."
Howard did not take the bait, and he was not going to get into it with her.
"Just go easy on your brother," he said. "You two need each other. And I need to know that you're there for him in case we're not."
Carrie understood the subtext. She nodded glumly at the thought of her parents' demise. It would be many years away, she prayed, but one day they would be gone. And her dad was right. She would be Adam's lifeline.
"You can count on me, Dad," Carrie said. "I won't ever let him go."
Howard leaned forward and kissed his daughter gently on the cheek.
"Good," he said.
And with that, Howard headed down the driveway to go looking for his son. Chapter 39. At 5:30 the next morning, Carrie was back at the VA for Gerald Wright's DBS surgery. Parkinson's disease had crept into and enveloped the retired lieutenant colonel's life over the previous 15 years. And as with all the other PD candidates for DBS, medication management had become unreliable. The surgical team, including Carrie, Dr. Finley, and the anesthesiologist, Dr. Kaufman, met to review Wright's MRI from the day before and the CT scan from that morning to determine where best to insert the leads. To Carrie's surprise, Dr. Evan Navarro showed up for the meeting. The images had just been brought up on the computer when Navarro entered the conference room without knocking, as though he belonged there. He gave Carrie a cool smile as he walked through the door.
"What are you doing here, Evan?"
Carrie asked.
"Sandra wanted me to observe this morning," Navarro said.
He fell silent, feeling no compulsion to further elaborate. Carrie's heart began to thunder. In the aftermath of yesterday's tumult in the park, she gave serious consideration to the possibility that the missing vets, the encounter with the jogger, and the ransacking of her room were all somehow connected. Now that Navarro had shown up unexpectedly, this notion took deeper roots. Navarro looked snappy in his white lab coat, red and white striped tie, and dark trousers. His hair looked extra oily, slicked back as if in homage to Eddie Munster, widow's peak and all. Carrie bristled at the thought of him joining her. A glance told her that Dr. Finley was equally displeased.
"Why would Dr. Goodwin want that?"
Carrie asked.
"Surgery is her department, Carrie," Navarro answered coolly. "I don't ask how she runs it, I just do my job."
His tone was condescending, implying Carrie would benefit from doing the same. Dr. Finley stepped forward.
"This is entirely inappropriate, Evan."
His face was a shade of crimson Carrie had never seen on him before.
"Nobody cleared this with me."
Navarro just shrugged.
"You'll have to take that up with Sandra too, I guess."
"And I damn well will do just that," Dr. Finley said. "We both know what this is about, don't we, Evan? And it's total bullcrap."
Navarro's smarmy expression set Carrie's blood on fire.
"Well, Alistair, last I checked, this is surgery that you're doing here, and that would be my boss's area of responsibility. So I can only offer the same reply to you that I just gave to Carrie, which is if you don't want me here, you'll need to take that up with Sandra. Otherwise, I'm not interested in pissing her off today, or any day, for that matter."
Navarro set his beady little eyes on Carrie. She glanced over at Dr. Finley, who glowered at Navarro until he softened. No value in wasting energy, his expression conveyed. He pulled Carrie aside.
"I suspect this is a bit of payback for questioning her AMA orders," Dr. Finley said in a whispered voice. "I know her style. She's letting you know you're on notice. Don't worry about it and try to ignore Navarro if you can. I'll speak to Sandra after and see if I can smooth things over. Nobody wants to work under a microscope."
Carrie gave a nod. She had her own payback in mind for Goodwin, and after the surgery, she would help David make that plan a reality. For now, Carrie would dedicate all her attention to her patient and ignore Navarro, as Dr. Finley advised. The question now was where to place the electrodes. Wright's facial inexpressiveness, unblinking, vacant stare, and almost inaudible whisper of a voice belied a reasonably intact intellect, but significant personality and behavioral problems had influenced Dr. Finley's decision. The apathy and depression, for example. Were these behaviors a direct consequence of his disease, or an understandable psychiatric reaction to the devastations of a failing motor system? Wright had had enough problems for Dr. Finley to decide on the right globus pallidus interna for the stimulating electrode target. This would seem to afford the best opportunity to reduce the left arm tremor and improve Gerald Wright's overall motor status. Dr. Finley and Carrie considered other target placements, but the risk of psychiatric complications favored the GPI as the better choice.
"He may be a bilateral case," Dr. Finley told Carrie as she went in to scrub for the surgery. "But let's see how he does with this side first. He's pretty intact cognitively, but I'm concerned about his behaviors and the neuropsych testing reports we've gotten back."
Carrie was still schooling herself in the subtleties of Parkinson's disease and the options of DBS surgeries. Like everything else in medicine, this was a rapidly evolving discipline, meaning patient and doctor alike were on steeply ascending learning curves. Carrie reprimanded herself for not spending more time studying about PD, even though she was still new to the program. She'd had too many distractions, like missing vets. The familiar harsh smell of betadine scrub and the lather up above her elbows brought her mind back to the problem at hand. Retired LTC Gerald Wright. She smiled slightly beneath her mask. Despite all that was going on, she was still a surgeon at heart, and she could focus all her attention on her profession and the task at hand. Funny how at the most unpredictable of times, she became aware of the transformational effects of training. No one had ever taught her to feel like a competent doctor, a leader, but that was how she felt as she did her second scrub midway up the forearms, and then the third, just the hands. She entered the OR not feeling as comfortably in the zone as she was accustomed. The procedure was becoming commonplace, which played in her favor,
Affix the stereotactic frame with 4 screws under local anesthesia first thing in the morning, then down to MRI for ultra-thin slices, with the images sent over to the planning station in the OR. Carrie selected the optimum XYZ coordinates to minimize risk of brain injury or hemorrhage as the needle advanced its way to Gerald Wright's globus pallidus interna. He was awake for this procedure, kept comfortable with just the right amount of propofol. That way, Dr. Finley could monitor the patient's motor status directly and also use the electrode recording techniques that signaled their specific placement. They were a team now, Dr. Alistair Finley and Dr. Carrie Bryant. They were able to carry out the extended, time-consuming procedure with little back-and-forth dialogue, as if they were reading each other's thoughts, despite the fact that they had worked together on only a handful of cases. Evan Navarro's presence was as innocuous as the familiar sounds of the operating room machinery. Maybe the choice of music helped Carrie block out the unpleasant distraction. Gerald Wright was also a jazz fan, and he had requested Bill Evans' Portrait in Jazz for his big day in the OR. The melodies reminded Carrie of her life at BCH, and friends like Valerie, with whom she was no longer in touch. Even in the Facebook era, friendships forged at work faded quickly once that bond was broken. But now she had a new community, a new team she counted on and who counted on her.
Are you doing all right, Carrie?
Carrie's focus had been so total that Dr. Finley repeated himself.
Yeah, I'm fine. Why?
You're about to go off your line by about 3 micrometers. Do you need a rest?
I'm sorry, Carrie said. Maybe just a minute and some water.
Navarro's black eyes seemed to be smiling. Carrie was not 100%, and Dr. Finley seemed to know it. A thin film of grit blanketed her eyes, left behind from a bad night's sleep, plagued by nightmares of men chasing her in the dark. Adam had crashed on the couch watching TV, and Carrie woke him by accident getting ready for work. Yesterday's fight was in the past. He had smiled warmly at her and wished her a good day without having read the long note of apology Carrie had left on the kitchen table. Seeing Navarro's wicked look made Carrie more willing to believe her brother. Could Evan Navarro have been in her bedroom? Could Goodwin have put him up to it? And if so, why? Carrie had a gut feeling that bugging Goodwin's office would get her some answers. After a short break, Carrie resumed her work. Dr. Finley recorded the electrical discharge patterns as Carrie sank the electrodes on the sweet spot. Navarro did not stay for the entire show. Evidently, he had made his point and was off to other things. Soon enough, he or one of his residents would be looking in on Gerald Wright, and Carrie would probably never see this patient again. Even if everything that had been happening lately had a logical explanation, Carrie doubted she could continue to work under such rigid constraints. In total, it took 7 hours to drill the holes and close up the skull, and in that time, Carrie developed knots in her shoulders the size of walnuts.
"You seemed a little off today," Dr. Finley said back in the scrub room. "You sure everything is okay?"
"Navarro had me a bit rattled," Carrie replied.
"Well, leave that to me. I'm going to speak with Sandra right now. That won't happen again, I assure you."
Carrie went to the locker room to take a shower and get changed. After that, she stopped by the hospital cafeteria for her second coffee of the day. Next, it was on to the front desk, where Carrie would arrange a temporary ID for David Hoffman. They had settled on the ruse that he was a medical student coming to the VA tonight to help with some research. To keep their activities as covert as possible, David asked Carrie to use an alias, and she picked Michael Stephen, which were the first two names that had popped into her head. She texted David her chosen moniker and headed to an on-call room to grab a few hours of shut-eye on the narrow industrial bed before Mission Possible commenced. Carrie's cell phone buzzed in her lab coat pocket, which she assumed was David responding. She checked the number, but did not recognize the caller.
"Hello, Dr. Carrie Bryant speaking."
"Dr. Bryant, I'm Dr. Abby Smerling from Seacoast Memorial Hospital in Maine." Carrie's entire body came alive.
"Yes, Dr. Smerling, what can I do for you?"
"You placed a call regarding a patient, Dr. Sam Rockwell, and asked to be notified if there were any developments." Carrie braced for the news to come. A potential link to the mystery of what might have happened to Abington and Fasciani had probably just died.
"Yes, that's correct," Carrie said.
"Well, I have some good news to share." This was what Carrie had hoped for. It was common practice for doctors to share patient information with other doctors, irrespective of the new privacy laws.